You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is a show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is Megan Hunter, talking about her second novel, The Harpy. We'll also hear from Helen Callahan on her latest psychological thriller, Night Falls, Still Missing. And James Raven discusses the Oxford Illustrated History of the Book. But Megan, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you. Lovely to be here again.
Nice to have you with us. And we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But Oxford Illustrated History of the Book. We're letting Oxford in there, but actually this is quite a Cambridge-centric programme. Both James and Helen are Cambridge-based. You too? Are you Cambridge-based?
Pretty much, yeah. Just recently I moved out to a village just outside Cambridge, but yes, I'm pretty much still a Cambridge girl.
Are you Cambridge-born and bred?
I wasn't born here. I was born in Manchester, but I've lived the vast majority of my life I've lived in Cambridge. So yeah, it's definitely, I feel like it's my hometown.
And didn't you study at the university for a while?
I did an MPhil at Cambridge just for a year. It's nice to kind of have that insight into the town as well and to have seen what's behind all those big walls everywhere.
And The Harpy is set in Cambridge, I think. It's never mentioned what city it's set in. Why is that? Why don't you ever say?
Yeah, I think sometimes I have a bit of a reluctance to use names and to use specific places. I think I like to leave that to be sort of filled in by the reader, or just more of a sense of perhaps timelessness, or it's not that it doesn't have a place, but that the place is unique to the book, I suppose, rather than being, oh yes, that's Cambridge, and then everybody puts all of their own sort of associations onto there. I mean, I did, in my mind, I could see Cambridge when I was writing it, and people have said that it, you know, it could be Cambridge, possibly Oxford. But it is a very, I would say it's a very locally set book. I think you can tell that, but not in terms of it being named or specified, just in an atmospheric sense, I hope.
But it was grounded in a real city, because you could have invented a place.
Yes, no, it is grounded in a real city. And I did, when I was imagining her moving around the city, I used my sense of Cambridge as that sort of basis. But it's a bit like when you write about a person who might be vaguely based on a person that you know. You're never really writing about, you know, you always recreate things as you write. It's never really the same. So I feel like it's its own Cambridge, really, the Cambridge of the book.
I can't wait to talk to you about the book. But let's listen to your first choice of music in just a moment. But is music important to you, Megan?
Very important. I listen to music as I write, and I find that gives me the sort of sense of liveliness that I need, particularly these days when I write on my own in my writing shed in the garden, whereas for years I worked in libraries and cafes. So I wrote The End We Start From in a cafe, and I wrote The Harpy in a library. Generally that suits me, to have people around and to have the stimulus anyway, but music helps with that. I used to have both people watching and music, but now I just have music and sort of the trees, which is fine as well and has its own advantages. But yes, I find it helps to set atmosphere and rhythm, and I have playlists for different books, and yeah, I'm very into that meeting point between music and writing.
This one is Kate Bush and Mrs. Bartolosi. Was this on your most recent playlist?
It's interesting. There are songs that I listened to when I was writing the book, but when I came to choose these songs, I didn't necessarily think that I wanted to play those songs, because the way that they're related to the book is quite obscure to me, and they're just sort of, I don't know, a particular melody or something. But the pieces that I've chosen today are more thematically linked. So the Kate Bush track, it's really about domesticity, and possibly the only, I'm sure it's not the only, but one of the only pop songs about a washing machine. And it's very centered on this washing machine, and I find it funny and beautiful. And one of my aims in my first two books is to write about domesticity in a way that doesn't flatten it or make it seem boring, that actually as important a part of life as any other. And so I think that domesticity in the song was what led me to choose it.
All over the whole carpet. took my mop and my bucket and I cleaned and I cleaned the kitchen floor until it sparkled.
That was Mrs. Bartolozzi by Kate Bush, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Megan Hunter. Megan's first novel, The End We Start From, was published in 2017 and has been translated into 8 languages. It was shortlisted for Novel of the Year at the Books in My Bag Awards, longlisted for the Aspen Words Prize, and was a Barnes & Noble Discover Awards finalist and won the Foreword Review's Editor's Choice Award. Her second novel, The Harpy, came out last month. The Scotsman called it a gripping, psychologically astute account of a relationship in freefall, and Esther Freud described it as utterly compelling, precise and darkly truthful. It succeeded in illuminating with flair and originality the damage done by betrayal. Well, I absolutely loved this novel, Megan. Can't wait to talk to you about it. But before we do that, when you've had a first novel that's so successful, is it difficult when you come to write the second one? It's a nice problem to have, but does it put an additional bit of pressure on?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it's like to have a book that wins the Booker Prize or something like that. But I didn't necessarily feel, I was aware The End We Start From had done well in a sense, but I didn't necessarily feel, oh, I'm launching off from sort of such a successful point. I think it's hard as a writer to feel that you are successful. I don't know, or perhaps I didn't always feel like that, but at times I did feel the pressure of launching off from that first book point. And I suppose in some ways I felt as though I had things to prove after The End We Start From, because it's so short and it's such a strange form. In some ways you could say it's not really a novel, it's more of a prose poem, or you know, it's a certain kind of novel. So I think I had on the one sense a pressure of feeling that yes, there's been a certain degree of success, and on the other hand a sense of, well, where do I go from here? What's next? It didn't seem clear. I didn't feel that I wanted to kind of repeat The End We Start From, but that was something that needed to be worked out over time, you know, what form the book was going to take and whether it was going to be similar or different to my first book. I think it takes time, I think, to work those things out.
Yes, this is quite different to your first novel, certainly in form. The subject matter, as we've alluded to, is the same, but the first one was very poetic and this is more prose-like, so that was obviously a conscious choice.
Yes, I read a lot, you know, in between. I think one of the main things I did was just read as well as writing. And I read a lot of different things. And I kind of went, to a certain extent, it was determined by what I was drawn to in my reading. So I found myself very, very drawn to Alice Munro for a long time when I was in preparation for writing the second book. And I read a huge amount of her stories. And not to say that then I write like her. It's not, I mean, I wish, but you know, it's like, for me, it's that's the way it works. It's a sort of pattern of influence, and kind of, I think for most people, you know, the writing follows the reading. And I sort of wanted to be able to write slightly longer sentences, slightly longer paragraphs, you know, scenes in which things happen and people speak to each other, and, you know, partly to show that to myself that I could do that, and that, you know, I wasn't just these sort of very fragmentary note-like, diary-like glimpses. I feel much freer moving into the third book, having now done that, because I know, okay, I can do that. I'm not just limited to that very, very condensed form.
So for people who haven't read The Harpy, because it is just out, what's it about?
So The Harpy is about a woman, Lucy. She's married to Jake, and one day she receives a very devastating phone call, a man who tells her that Jake has been having an affair with his wife. And the story is basically what happens from that point onwards, what happens from that disaster, if you like, and the ways in which as a family they work through that, which sounds very positive and sort of healing, and in this case it's not very positive or healing, which I don't think is a spoiler, but they decide that to sort of set the score straight, Lucy will hurt Jake 3 times. So that's the premise of the book. It's about these hurts, and it's almost a sort of fairy tale patterning onto a kind of realistic domestic setting.
And why The Harpy?
The Harpy came to me towards the end of the first draft of the book. I thought it was just going to be about the three hurts and the relationship. And then towards the end, The Harpy really emerged quite organically, almost as a sort of image in my mind. And then as I started to write her into the book, I felt the presence of the harpy quite viscerally, with the feathers and the nails, and that I felt the very, very strong sense of the harpy. And that's how I knew that it was going to be an important part of the book. And then the exact form that the harpy took in the book and the exact relationship of the harpy and to Lucy evolved through the different drafts and came to be this sort of lingering presence that then increases in importance as the book goes on.
And a harpy, for those who don't know, is a sort of half woman, half bird-like figure from mythology.
Yes, so the harpy is a figure from classical mythology. I mean, interestingly, lots of different layers, which I explore a bit in the book. The harpy was often talked about as a storm, as an actual impersonal presence. And then there's the evolution into this figure that is a woman, but with wings and with talons, usually a woman's face, but bird body in the main. But there are so many different depictions. Some of them are very beautiful and kind of idealized, and some of them are very haggard and scary. And, you know, and in the main, the harpy is described as being, you know, smelly, hungry, vicious, revengeful. And she's a kind of messenger in a sense of the gods. So she's someone that gods send to punish people. And in the book, Lucy has been somebody who has been very interested in the harpy and has researched and explored the harpy. But the book has its own sense of the harpy, as it were. It's not necessarily the classical harpy that is the harpy of the book, without giving too much away.
This is quite uncomfortable terrain to read. As I say, I enjoyed it very much, but this kind of dark side of domesticity, yeah, very unsettling for the reader.
Yes, I mean, it is unsettling. And, you know, I've had people say, you know, they're very uncomfortable, very unsettled, as a criticism, which is fine as well, because not that won't be to everybody's taste. But actually, that is my intention. My intention is certainly for it to be unsettling. It's a dark book, it's an unsettling book, a disquieting book. And I think that it's particularly difficult to see sort of the safe domestic home as a place of threat and danger and unraveling. And the mother, particularly, who is, you know, we still have, perhaps as Virginia Woolf talked about, you know, that angel of the house image, the mother, we want her to be kind of endlessly kind and warm and forgiving. And I think we still want that. I mean, we want that as children, but then also we want that as a society, as a culture, we expect that. And Lucy very much doesn't toe that line. She tries, and she does at the beginning, but the pressures on her are such, and her sort of alienation from her own environment and her own situation becomes so acute that she's very much not able to be that figure anymore. And that's what it's about, really. Partly the book is about our idealization of motherhood, but about how that is actually a very persecutory ideal, really, for women, and how that in this particular story changes and unravels and transforms one particular woman.
And you've made it clear in the book, you're the mother of two children, but you made it clear in the afterword that your children and your husband are not in the book.
Yeah.
But did you pull on some of your own experiences of motherhood?
Yes, I was torn about whether to say that in the acknowledgements or not. But then I think it was important for me to do so, because I know the way that books are often received, particularly by women, novels, as being autobiographical until proven otherwise. And it's a made-up story. I'm a fiction writer. I make things up. In the end, we start from, I wrote about a dystopian catastrophic flood. I've not lived through a dystopian catastrophic flood. I haven't lived through any of the things that happen in this book. I mean, in terms of the main events of the book, but I have been a mother, and I have had times where I've been the one at home looking after the children. Although again, actually, that hasn't been my dominant experience of motherhood. I've often been working, and my husband's often been at home. So it's not about me and our situation. But I think I've been interested in observing motherhood in general as a societal structure, and how most commonly women are still the ones doing the majority of the childcare and the housework, and how that affects us, because we feel as though we've moved beyond that in some ways. Now we're equal, we both work, but actually it's still the women most often, you know, organising the children's parties or doing the school run or all the things that Lucy does in the book, cooking the dinner and sorting out the laundry. Statistically, that's just the fact, is that that is mainly women still, or women do that more than men still. And I think that was just something I was interested to write about, really. It was just a sort of preoccupation of mine, you know, not entirely in a negative way. It's also about how that can be a very particular experience, you know, being within one home, one house. I write a lot about Lucy's relationship to her home and her house, and how she feels this quite intense sort of profound attachment to her house, actually, which is then complicated by the fact that she rents the house. She doesn't own it. So there's a kind of economic complication there as well.
We're going back to hear from Helen Callahan, who writes psychological thrillers. It seemed to me that one of the things that you're exploring, one of the other things that you're exploring in this book is what is violence? Because we've got psychological violence. Physical violence is written about, not almost tenderly, but quite gently. There's an interesting discussion about what is violence in the book, I think.
Yes, definitely. I think I was really interested to write about violence. I mean, it's not, I think so far in my books, I've been drawn to, rather than my direct experiences in terms of the main subject matter, it's actually perhaps my deepest, darkest fears, you know. And I think that violence is something that, I mean, I abhor violence, but I think that it's a very interesting wound to explore and to investigate and to write about. I think times I felt like, why am I writing about this? This doesn't seem to be what I'm sort of about as a person. I'm not a, but there's something about actually allowing yourself to go to that shadow side or that darker place within yourself. It opens things up a bit, I think, and it opens up, as you say, complications about violence and about what it is. Where are the different overlaps and different terrains between emotional violence and physical violence? There are lots of different kinds of violence in the novel, and I sort of explore what effects those have on Lucy and on her family.
Thank you, Megan. Well, let's stay in that dark side for just a minute when we hear from Helen. Helen Callahan's debut novel, Dear Amy, was published in 2017. A psychological thriller, it became a Sunday Times bestseller, with the Irish Independent describing it as first rate. Everything Is Lies came out a year later, and earlier this year, her third novel, Nightfall Still Missing, was published. When I chatted to Helen via Zoom, I asked her to tell me what the novel is about.
Nightfall Is Still Missing is about an archaeology lecturer, Fiona, who has a best friend called Madison, who's also an archaeologist. They've grown up together. Madison gets in touch and says, I really need you to come down here. I'm in trouble. And Fiona assumes that this is connected to Madison's stalker boyfriend. So being a good friend, she does go down. However, when she reaches Orkney, it's a dig, it's the middle of winter. Madison's not there to meet her at the pier. And also Madison appears to have vanished. At first, Fiona's very alarmed, and then it turns out that Madison has been telling quite a few lies about her situation. She's been telling different people different things. So as a consequence, Fiona has to sort of like try and get to the truth and find out, is Madison in danger? What is going on with her? While she does this, she gets a chance to review their friendship, which Fiona's always kind of viewed as a bit one-sided. And it turns out that Madison is in real danger. So beyond that, I don't think I'll say much more.
So this is a psychological thriller. Is that your genre now? Is that how you would describe it as a psychological
thriller? Yes, it's a psychological thriller. It's like the other two. The next one will be one as well. I really enjoy them, whatever they're about, because they're, I think inherently all books, all really good books, have a mystery at the centre. Even if they're romances, even if they're science fiction, you go on a journey where there is some secret, there is something that everyone needs to learn in order to move on. You know, there's something to be resolved.
This one's got archaeology at its centre, which is one of your loves, isn't it? You studied archaeology, so clearly the love for it hasn't gone away.
No, never. It was what I studied at university. It was interesting, though, because for this book, because I'd invidious amount of time ago, I had been to university, and I thought, well, I should really brush up, because it could be completely different. And I took a weekend class over at the ICE, and I was asking the professor, well, you know, I'm writing this book and I feel like I should brush up on my archaeology because it's probably changed loads. And he was like, no. It's like, okay then. And I actually did, so they're digging out in Norstow. They've got a site that's been going for a few years. And it turns out in Norstow, which is like, there's nothing there now. They're building housing estates, but it was kind of broken land. And when they started digging, they found there'd actually been like quite a large town there. So when you go, there's like acres and acres of site. And it was a beautiful day. It was a couple of years ago. It was a beautiful day and dug there in the sun. And, you know, I mean, it was really nice to get back in touch with it, to be honest. It was very interesting.
And this novel set in the Orkney Islands. The Orkney Islands are so rich, aren't they, for archaeologists, but just in terms of location for a thriller as well.
Yeah. And I've been going there for years. I'd take little writing retreats in the winter because the winter is the best time to do it because you get this like window of time to do your day things, and the days are very, very short and the nights are long. So you go walk and you'd hike and just beautiful, beautiful scenery and sea, and go home and write in the evenings. So I'd been doing that and I thought, you know, this would be a really great place to set a novel. But I could never think of the novel that would go with it, but it grew on me, bits and pieces, over the years.
And I like the fact that the friendship between the two women, Fiona and Madison, it's challenging. Madison is a challenging character. It's often when we see female friendships in novels, it's great. You know, they're strong and they're positive. But friendships can be more nuanced and layered than that.
Well, this is it. I thought when I was writing it, because you generally see two female friendships. You have like the friend that cheerleads for the heroine in the background, very supportive. Or you have bitchy frenemy type relationships. And they're generally about men. Because my feeling is that the people that you are closest to and know the most about you are the most in the position to hurt you. And those are the most spiky and difficult relationships. I mean, like if most people think about the relationships they have with their partners or their significant others, it's certainly true. So I wanted to have a friendship where they do occasionally take each other for granted, where they do the wrong thing sometimes, that they're sometimes not there for one another. But ultimately, they love each other very much. And they can call on each other in the darkest hours of their lives. And that's what the book's about.
And we're speaking to each other during lockdown. How have you been finding lockdown creatively for you?
It's really weird because I loved it at first. Loved is the wrong word because there was so much fear and uncertainty. But it suited me because I work from home anyway. But what I hadn't realized about myself is that because I'm kind of like, I live alone and I work at home, I outsource my social engagement. So I have a wide circle of friend and family that I visit and spend time with, and all of that was suddenly gone. And yeah, I could talk to them on Zoom, but it just absolutely wasn't the same. Because we were all in the same boat, I was able to keep going quite well for a couple of months. There was a fitness regime and there was routine. But then very quickly, it started to, I don't know, it was just like, it was once lockdown lifted, but it became apparent that this wasn't going to be going anywhere soon. It started to get like a bit, because you would think being stuck in the house alone with no distractions that you would be more creative, but actually you're not. A lot of your creative engagement is sparked with conversations and things you do with people. So I found that quite difficult. The most interesting part about it, of course, is how you write the book then. Because all contemporary psychological thrillers, you know, even the famous ones like Rebecca were contemporary when they were written. The thesis behind a psychological thriller is that this could happen to you now, like right now. And it's very, very hard to characterize now. Do you put the COVID stuff in and then it's always going to be dated? It's always going to be this book that happened over the course of a year in turn of the decade? Or is it going to be that we're going to be living with this for a little while now, and to pretend it never happened is wildly unrealistic? There's been a lot of debate around that. And when I speak to other authors, that's what we talk about. So are you putting in, are you not?
And what have you concluded? Because as you say, it will date it, but it may be, horrible as it is, provides you with opportunities as well.
Someone was saying this the other day, there is going to be an amazing lockdown novel. And I had a few ideas for a lockdown novel. But there are problems around writing lockdown right now, because what happened was when it very first came off, loads of books were postponed. So we're seeing like this big glut of books that are coming out right now. It does affect production. It also affects what people want to read. There's more of a move to escapism, I think, in what people are reading now. So at the moment, how I'm tackling it is it's something that weaves itself in and out of the drafts. So basically, to keep my own head straight, I'm writing it as though COVID's happening. I'm making those COVID references. It could well be by the time that the book is getting nearer and nearer completion and COVID is this thing that happened in the past, I'll take them out. But for the moment, I find it very hard to write without referencing it in some way, because it just is so pervasive, and to write authentically, it has to resemble real life.
Interesting what you're saying about a psychological thriller, feeling that it could be something that happens to you now. So it suddenly occurred to me, yes, of course, I can't think of any psychological thrillers that are historical. I suppose that's not possible given what you say about the genre, how you've described it.
I think there are a couple of Daphne du Maurier. My memory of my cousin Rachel is that it takes place in a time roughly before. And that, I suppose, is a psychological thriller. But in the main, 99.9% of the ones that are doing well at the moment are not historical. And also, as I suppose I would say, you're all about cutting out the distance, as much of the distance as you possibly can, in the situation between the protagonist and the person that's reading the book. They're meant to be scary because they're quiet things that come into your own life. It can be quite hard actually to write them because, like, not everyone's digging out on Orkney, but certainly people are in the situations where they've got friends who have abusive boyfriends and they've got friendships where, you know what I mean? Someone, can she entirely be trusted?
Mm-hmm. What else makes a good psychological thriller?
So there's tension, there's a race against the clock. One of the things that I did in the new one, which I had not done so much with the others, was it seemed to me very important that it just happened over a few days. Nightfall Still Missing happens over 5 or 6 days. But that is its own challenge then, because one of the two major characters, one of them is missing at the beginning of the book, and you're hearing contradictory things about where she is and what she's doing. So in that sense, there had to be flashbacks on the friendship so that the reader can come to their own assessment about what's happened to Madison, rather than have Fiona say, Madison's like this, Madison's like that, especially when Fiona's like not necessarily the most reliable person to be giving you information on Madison. And that was really challenging. So anyway, it's all about small, it's small cast of characters, sort of small time, small this. So it's intimate and cramped and you don't quite know what's going on. Those are quite good things, I think.
Nightfall's Still Missing by Helen Callahan is published by Michael Joseph. Our featured guest on Bookmark today is Megan Hunter, here to talk about her second novel, The Harpy. Megan, I was talking to Helen there about female friendships and the female friendships in Nightfall Still Missing. Slightly scratchy. Friendships, interestingly, absent in The Harpy. Lucy seems a very solitary figure.
She is. Yeah, it's something I was quite aware of and I thought about quite a lot when I was writing the book. But I think that it's important, very important for Lucy to be quite an isolated character, because actually, I'm not sure if she had really good friends if this whole story would have unfolded in the same way. I think we can probably both imagine what we would say if one of our friends said, I'd found out my husband's having an affair and this is what we're going to do about it. I think we would say, that's an incredibly bad idea. So her isolation is very much part of her character. She is isolated. Sadly, I think it's already more common than people might think. I think motherhood can be quite an isolating time for women if they don't build up those sort of support networks that are not necessarily automatically there. There are ways to kind of find people and reach people. But if you don't have friends with children or friends who are good friends who are nearby, or, you know, family nearby, I think it does happen to people that they end up feeling very alone. And it doesn't, perhaps motherhood doesn't perhaps provide those sort of natural recourses to friendship, because if you're not going to a workplace where you're meeting people, you know, Lucy works from home on her own. So yes, her isolation is crucial really to the unfolding of her character and to a certain extent to her unhappiness actually. So I think she would be happier and a different character and not befall these terrible things if she did have good friends, but then that would be a completely different book.
It seems a novel that's apt for lockdown and for the time we're in, because so much of it is in her head and isolated. Even though she's living in this city, she is still very much confined to her thoughts.
She is, yes. And one of the things I've been interested to observe in lockdown is the way that it really puts the emphasis on the nuclear family. At the moment we're, I don't know, fearing the next announcement that, you know, that we can't mix with other households. And the fact of that is, you know, if you imagine that situation for Lucy and her family, or for people who are struggling and suffering in their family situations, you know, it's incredibly difficult because it puts all of the pressure onto that one family unit. And actually, because they don't have these strong support systems and these connections and help really in their lives, Lucy and Jake, you know, they are in an isolated nuclear bubble, as it were. I think that's the connection that I've seen, that there is this nuclear family isolation in the book, and we see how that plays out and has certain quite difficult consequences. In terms of her being in her own head, it is very much that first person, very, very close. I think when I write first person, I really like to be as close as I possibly can to the narrator and give the reader that really intimate sense that you're very much in her head and you're in her body. And I think particularly being in her body is incredibly important for The Harpy and for what happens to Lucy in the novel.
Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is I Get Along Without You Very Well by Nina Simone. Why this one?
Oh, it's so sad, this song. I mean, I love it. It's just so incredibly beautiful. And I love the way Nina Simone sings it. But it's just a very sad, mournful song. And I think that there is a thread of very deep sadness running through the harpy of things that are lost to Lucy. And obviously central to that is her marriage, and it was a genuine love of her life, and that has now become so painful. I mean, I've always loved this song, but I think I thought that it might be appropriate.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do. But I get along without you very well.
Cambridge 105 Radio. Kickstart your weekend.
Saturday Breakfast with Matt Webb.
I'm here every weekend to get you moving. I have the latest from the Cambridge News Desk on the hour and half hour. Problems on the A14, Newmarket Road or Mill Road? Well, if there are, you'll be the first to know in the travel. There's a full sports roundup at 8:30, including what's happening at Cambridge United and our other local clubs. Plus a look at the Saturday papers and local online publications at 10 to 9. That's Saturday Breakfast with me, Matt Webb, this weekend from 8.
If you're like me, you've got a family and a business, and you want to protect what's most important when the chips are down. With Woodfine Solicitors, that's exactly what happens. I got a bespoke legal service from a friendly, expert team. They really listened to what was going on and tailored their recommendations to my situation, which was, well, that's another story. Anyway, the best thing was that it all happened online. A few simple clicks and I had my quote. That freed up time to focus on everything else. Get the help you need when you need it most. Visit woodfines.co.uk or call Cambridge 411 421. Woodfines, cutting through the red tape.
What does your home need to feel complete? Gap Home Improvements have been helping customers give their properties that curb appeal for over 20 years. You've seen our vans in your area providing dedicated support to families across Cambridgeshire. Windows, doors, garden rooms, conservatories and warm roofs. We offer free quotations in a pressure-free environment. In person, on the phone or by video call, our consultants will help you realise your property's true potential. Call Cambridge 914 567 or visit gaphomeimprovements.co.uk today.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Megan Hunter, talking about her novel, The Harpy. Megan, just to talk about your writing style for a little bit, I was struck by what the Scotsman said in their review when they talked about your writing style, comparing it to your first novel, The End We Start From. Rather than trying to land a haymaker with every punch, it said, it's as if Hunter is learning how to box clever, adding more variety to her repertoire, ducking and weaving before landing a decisive blow. That's something you recognise in your writing, that you write with this very poetic, I think shimmery style, one reviewer called it, but it feels more stretched out in this novel, more elongated.
Yes, I mean, I think that it's a natural consequence of writing in that slightly looser form. I mean, I'm aware that it's hardly a very long form prose still, but it's it's a slight loosening from the end we start from. And, you know, I think every book finds its own form. I wouldn't say, you know, I'm necessarily moving in a particular direction. I might write something like The End We Start From again. But I feel like, yes, with this book, it wouldn't have worked to have a sort of vivid simile or metaphor for every other line, because you need to be immersed in Lucy's world of the day-to-day. It's a more, not mundane in a negative sense, but it's very much the everyday and the daily, and that has its own musicality, as it were. The changing of the day from the afternoon to the evening, to that you need to have that sense of being in time with Lucy. Very, very vivid poetic language can sort of pull you out of time, you know, in a good way. But I wanted the reader to have that sense of immersion in the text. You know, I'm finding my way. It's only my second book. What I've experienced so far is that every book has its own form. And so it's not sort of, I'm going to write in this way forever. But, you know, who knows? I'm still at quite an early stage.
How much editorial input did you have into that? Because very honestly, in the afterword, I think you mentioned 4 editors in your thanks. Yeah.
Yes. Well, in America, I have 2 editors, which is wonderful, and then who work together. And then in the UK, one of my editors was on maternity leave, so I had a lovely editor for that time as well. So that's why there are 4. That's not the norm necessarily. I mean, I'm very, very lucky to work with incredible editors who are so supportive, and also to work with them at quite an early stage. I mean, you know, I'm writing my 3rd book now, and I'm talking about that with my editor. And I think it's a real privilege, really, to have that input. With The Harpy, it was a different process for me, because obviously The End We Start From was edited as I went along, so I wrote it in a different way. B, it had already gone through quite a lot of versions. I think that's a typical experience for your first novel, is that you, even before it gets to an agent, you know, you've already redrafted it a number of times. Then you probably work on it with your agent. So by the time it goes to the publisher, you know, it's going to be a lot more polished than subsequent novels, probably, which don't go through such a long sort of pre-editing process.
And we're about to hear from James Raven talking about the illustrated history of the book. I'm going to say, the cover of your book is stunning. What a stunning picture. It's a woman's face sort of enclosed, cloaked really with feathers. It's fantastic.
It was amazing, because they sent it to me and I just immediately thought, yes, absolutely. And I think it was the first image that I saw. And it is, it's absolutely beautiful and it's perfect. I'm just looking at it now. I love the, you know, the darkness that surrounds the central figure. It's a painting by Amy Judd. It's a piece of art. And so I'm very lucky to have it on the cover.
Thank you, Megan. Well, let's hear from James now. James is a fellow of the British Academy, and he's also a fellow of Magdalen College, Cambridge. He's director too of the Cambridge Project for the Book Trust. He edited the Oxford Illustrated History of the Book, which came out earlier this year. Kirkus called it a sweeping, erudite and thoroughly engaging narrative, a profusely illustrated, handsomely produced intellectual history. Before we talked in detail about the publication, I asked James how exactly he defined book.
Well, that's the big question, and that's the challenge really for this book. Once you start to think about what a book is over many centuries, then you realise that it was made of many, many different materials, originally from tortoise shell, bone, then clay, wood, bark, papyrus, all sorts of different materials, even before we start thinking about what we probably think of most often in terms of a book of paper and parchment, and then most recently sort of digital as well. And so you realise that the book was made of many, many different materials, but also different technologies. And so our definition can be really wide. Succinctly, what I would say would be that a book has to be legible. You have to be able to read it. And it also has to be portable. That's what distinguishes it, say, from a monument or something that's actually fixed. But actually, when you start to think about the different materials and technologies, our definition can be extremely wide indeed. And that's what this book is really all about.
Yes, I suppose for most people, they think of a book as starting with the printing press, with the invention of the printing press. But in the timeline at the beginning of the book, you go right back to circa 3500 BCE.
Exactly. And we can see those materials I just mentioned. Depends also about what the use of the book is. And so these early examples, often for divination and fortune telling and for very primitive sort of recording, were on tortoiseshell, pieces of bone and bark, and then on pieces of wood. Probably people also remember things like the clay cuneiform tablets from the Near East. But you're right, yes, most people think of it in terms of printing and of the codex, that is the book that opens with pages and a sort of a spine. But it may be, you know, now, particularly of the younger generations, particularly where their usage of reading a book always online on their tablet or their phone or whatever, that we're actually beginning to think, well, actually, a book could be really quite different from that thing that we think of as stacked on the shelf and made of paper with a spine and a cover.
And this is a series of essays from academics. How much freedom did you give them in terms of what they chose to write about? Because there's such a wide range of subjects covered.
Well, that was the challenge, really. We wanted to make it comparative. I've been working on the history of books and reading and publishing for many, many years. And it's become quite an interesting academic subject in terms of what the history of the book really is. But in recent years, we've really adopted a much more global dimension, because there's a realization not just about how ancient books are in many different forms, but how they vary around the world. So I selected 15 different contributors, all of whom had specialisms in different parts of the world and in different, sometimes different linguistic areas, for example, in the Arab world or in South Asia and East Asia. And I wanted them to write an essay that was really informative, but also spanned quite a broad period and was able to contain lots of really interesting examples and up-to-the-minute research as well. And I think it's come together extremely well, and it's beautifully illustrated.
Oh, it's beautifully illustrated. The photographs and the pictures are wonderful. Where did you find those?
Well, Oxford University Press has a series of illustrated histories, and so they were hugely helpful. But all of us, all the contributors, had their favourite examples. And one of the interesting things about the book is that you can read it in two ways. So that there's a narrative that goes through the text, but the images are actually standalone. So the contributors have tried, where possible, actually not to mention the image in their text, but to have the image as a standalone example, which has its own explanatory caption beside it or underneath it. So you can read it as a series of images or as a series of texts, which itself is, I think, quite an interesting take on the history of the book itself, because we can think about the relationship between text and image down the age as well. Some books, you know, are purely picture books. Other books combine images and writing systems right throughout the ages in different ways too.
And as you say, you've been studying books for some time. Did you learn things in this from the other essays that surprised you, that challenged you?
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of it. I think one can reread this, actually, and reflect really on all sorts of assumptions that we make. I'll give you one example. You rightly said that many people think about the books in terms of the arrival of printing, and more specifically in the West, the arrival of movable type with Gutenberg and then Caxton in the 15th century and the whole range of different types of printing that there was in the centuries after that. But of course, printing had gone on in East Asia many centuries before that, and in a different technological form through printing blocks, that's incised carved wooden blocks. And we have an assumption in the West that movable type is actually more efficient to do with the development of printing and so forth, and that the East is actually more, in a way, cumbersome. But actually, when you go into it, and this book shows how extraordinarily flexible the printing technique of woodblocks are, as long as you've got somewhere to actually store it, and that you can replicate books in a more interesting and actually in a more efficient way. So there's all sorts of comparisons that you can make when you start to think about the book on a global scale and through time. And it just really, so that's just one example. There are lots of others as well in that.
And what does studying the book tell us about ourselves and about society?
I think it tells us a great deal about how we communicate ideas. When you think about authorship and reading, the relationship between the creation of an idea and the diffusion of that idea and how it's received. So when you start to study the history of a book or a particular type of book, say the Bible or another religious book or a highly specific title, which has been replicated all around the world, translated and so forth, you can get an idea of how it comes across in its different forms, its different editions, and how it's been received over the centuries and in different parts of the world. Here's a vehicle. It's a vehicle for instruction, a vehicle for entertainment, a vehicle for the transmission of knowledge. So it's an extraordinary, in it were, node, really, in a communication circuit between the origination of an idea and the reception of that idea in so many ways. And that's why it's become such a fascinating subject in academic study, as well as, I think, generally in the last few years.
And hundreds, if not thousands, of books mentioned in this book. Do you have a favourite one?
It's difficult to have a favourite one. I think there's a glorious one. I mean, I think the Garima Gospel, one of the things about this sort of book is to think about books in parts of the world we tend to forget that had an interesting and long literate history. And the Garima Gospels, which were printed on goatskin in an early Ethiopian language, have survived in Ethiopia for centuries. They were produced in the 5th century. The reproduction here in the book shows it in all its glory, its beautiful colours, and again, the integration between the image and the text. But, you know, it's invidious to pick out one particular one. There are all sorts of extraordinary examples of books over the years, and the history of how they were made, history of how they were received is absolutely fascinating.
And in terms of evolution of books, have they gone as far as they can, do you think? I mean, if you had to predict what kind of books we'd be looking at in 100, 150 years' time, what would you predict? Or have we gone as far as we can?
We've got a great history, I think, of books, and can see from that the projection of the type of book there might be in the future. People will always want to read. They will always want to read on the move or to move their reading. And so the digital book, the portable form of the book, will be evolving, I think, at great speed in the next years. But an interesting aspect of that is what, in fact, the last chapter of this book notices, an interesting word that I hadn't come across before writing this book, about skeuomorphism, the skeuomorphism of a book, which is the extent to which we adopt a form with which we're happy, a traditional form, even though it's no longer really vital or crucial to the book. So, for example, if you think about the page, we scroll down a page on our digital tablet, but we don't necessarily need a page anymore. And so one of the interesting questions is, yes, I think there's a great future for the book as it develops digitally, but it will also, I think, at least in the short term, develop in ways which are familiar to us, so that we are sort of happy with the way in which we are reading and we are searching through the book. I mean, think also of the development of the index and searchable book and the way that we actually go in different ways through a book. That's being transformed as well. I think it's a very exciting future for the book.
And the Oxford Illustrated History of the Book, edited by James Raven, is published by Oxford University Press. We've been talking on Bookmark today to Megan Hunter about her novel, The Harpy, which is published by Picador. So, Megan, what next for you? You've alluded to the fact you're writing a third. Are you able to say more about that?
I don't really believe in that. I know it's annoying, but also I know myself and I know how often I slightly pivot and change direction with my books. But it is a novel and it's quite different. It's not so focused on, perhaps at the moment, it's not so focused on the motherhood part of life, shall we say. It's really wonderful to be writing another novel and just to have that kind of immersion again. I think it's a good thing in these times to kind of have an ongoing project, you know, something to take you day to day.
And the end we start from was optioned, the film rights were optioned for that. Is there any more news on that?
Well, I've read the screenplay now, which is wonderful. And so, yeah, it is moving forward. So that's exciting. As usual, I can't say that much about that, but I have read the screenplay, which was just such a strange and amazing experience. I've never experienced anything like it. It was just reading something that I've written that's been translated. I mean, my work has been translated, but sadly, I don't speak really any foreign languages fluently enough to read the translation. So, and that's a different kind of translation. But this is, it's translated, it's made new into this different form and envisaged for the film. And I love film. And I mean, that was lots of fun reading that.
And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
So I'm reading Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin, which is extraordinary. And I've read it before, and I think what happened was I read half of it unbelievably because it's so extraordinary, but then I got distracted by something else. But I'm having this very strange experience where I'm reading it again, definitely this half that I've read before, and I don't really remember it. It's this thing of encountering a book again a few years later, and it's not that it's not memorable. I mean, it's the most extraordinary, incredible book, but I just think it's so interesting how at different points in your life you encounter and you receive a book in such a different way that you can encounter it again and really encounter it as though it's completely new. Anyway, I'm reading that. I don't think anyone needs me to tell them that's extremely good.
Wait till you get to my age, Megan, and every time you pick up a book, it feels like the first time you read it, even if it's one of your favourites, your memory's shot. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music, but a heads up that on the next show, our featured guest is romance author Hannah Pearl. We'll also be hearing from Rowan McWilliam about his book on London's West End and also chatting to local author TJ Corliss. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, which is The Hissing of Summer Lawns by Joni Mitchell. Why this one?
Well, I adore Joni Mitchell, and this is one of my favourites. And it is, again, it's this sort of domestic uncanny, this kind of domesticity overlaid with creepiness, which I thought would be suitable for the harpy.
He bought her a dime for her throat. He put her in.